Hey there, and welcome to The Play's the Thing, Podcast 6, Old and New World Order, The Play's First 10 Minutes. My name is Andy Black, and I'm a playwright. This podcast series is being offered in conjunction with the Play Submissions Helper website. My own website is www.andrewblackplaywright.com. The Play Submissions Helper website is www.playsubmissionshelper.com. This podcast is going to talk about the structural element of the old and new world order. Actually, there's two structural elements I'm combining in one, old and new world order. I'm going to talk about what they are and why they're important. I'm going to look at some examples from some well-known plays, and we're going to look at how you can create a world in your narrative at the beginning of your play, and then touch back on some of the same elements at the end of the play that you created at its beginning to help your audience understand the meaning of your play and its theme through the use of those specific elements in what are sometimes called old and new world order. Since establishing the old world order is done at the top of the play, it made sense to include a special topic during this podcast, the play's first 10 minutes. I'm also going to throw in a little bit about the play's conclusion when we talk about new world order. Before we get into the content, however, I'm going to take care of a couple of administrative details. First of all, every podcast has a learning aid which can be downloaded from the Play Submissions Helper website in PDF form. The learning aid that goes with this podcast is called Podcast 6, Old and New World Order / The Play's First 10 Minutes. You will be able to follow along with some of the key points of this podcast by downloading, printing out, and then looking at this handout if you like. Secondly, who am I, Andrew Black, the playwright who is conducting this podcast? If you look in your handout on page 2, you'll see information about me and my background. I'm not going to go into any detail in this podcast. Other podcasts have a little bit more information if you want to hear me talking about my background in my own words. And if you want more information about me and how I'm qualified to talk about playwriting, you can go to my playwright's website, www.andrewblackplaywright.com. Finally, I'd like to say something about Play Submissions Helper, which is the series sponsor for this podcast. Play Submissions Helper, or PSH, is a community of more than 1,700 playwrights. Its goal is to help playwrights realize their dream of getting a play produced by saving them hours of time searching for theaters to which work can be submitted. For just $6.99 a month, PSH provides a compendium of hundreds of theaters and organizations that are accepting play submissions. It's the perfect system for a busy playwright who wants to focus on the craft of writing. If you haven't already done so, sign up now by going to www.playsubmissionshelper.com. Now, let's get started talking about old and new world order. If you look on page 3 of your handout, you'll see a list of the topics I'm going to be covering today. I've already done the startups, and I'll talk in just a moment about the teaching examples I'll be using in the podcast. I'll be talking about old and new world order, what are they and why are they important, and I'll be covering content like what is old world order, the protagonal point of view in old world order as a template for the new world order. I'm going to look at some alternative forms, such as the absurdist structure, and I'll talk about various kinds of plots in the New World Order. After I've covered that content, I'm going to be looking at the first 10 minutes of a play. I'll be talking about facts and exposition and how they're handled in the first 10 minutes, the protagonist point of view, storylines and key images. I'll cover tone and rules and how they can be revealed in the first 10 minutes. I'm going to talk about some pitfalls of the first 10 minutes of your story, and I'm going to talk about some ways to get the first 10 pages right. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about tying up the storylines at the end of the play. I'll summarize, and at the very end of the podcast, I'm going to give you some assignments if you want to deepen your understanding of the content that I've been covering in this session. I'm now on page 4 of your handout, and I'm going to talk briefly about the teaching examples I'll be using. One of the challenges of teaching playwriting is that it's quite helpful to use examples from great plays. Unfortunately, not all playwrights have read every single play. And I do suggest that aspiring playwrights need to familiarize themselves with the great works of the theater and seek them out if necessary. And you can seek them out by reading them. You can certainly watch DVD versions of them. And the best way to see them, of course, is to experience them in a real theater. This podcast is going to use 5 well-known plays or stories as its teaching examples. I'll refer to Shakespeare's Hamlet, Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry, The Wizard of Oz, the movie version, based on the book by Frank Baum, Henrik Ibsen's A Doll's House, and the musical The Music Man, written by Meredith Wilson. So on to our topic for today, Old and New World Order, What and Why. I'm up to page 4 in your handout now if you're following along. So Old and New World Order. Old World Order is sometimes called stasis. It defines the world of the play before the occurrence of the intrusion or the inciting incident. The intrusion is an event which upsets the apple cart or destroys the peace of mind of the protagonist and will be the subject of a later podcast. The old world order is important because it serves as a benchmark against which the audience can measure and, to an extent, understand the events which take place over the rest of the play. In most plays, the protagonist undergoes a journey. With a few exceptions, the protagonist is not the same at the end of the journey as he or she was when the journey began. The theme of the play is often revealed by the character's journey, and audiences frequently are looking for clues to determine what the theme or the message of the story is. These first clues to what the play is all about are found in the settings and dialogue of the old world order. So now that we have established what the old world order is and how it can be important, I'm going to look at the protagonist's point of view. The world of the play is seen through the eyes of the protagonist. The old world order defines the world of the play from that perspective and helps the audience understand who the protagonist is and how that individual understands the world that they're part of, and by extension, how the audience is going to experience that world as well. It's usually important to understand the state of mind and the essential temperament and attributes of the protagonist at the beginning of the play to understand the overall journey or character arc. The state of mind or essential character of the hero is revealed as part of the old world order. I use the word reveal here to describe a process of deduction by which the audience comes to understand who the protagonist is and what their world is all about. Audiences love to figure things out on their own, and this is a theme you'll hear me repeat several times during this podcast. And typically the identity of the hero or the heroine and the facts about the world that surround that individual are shown or indicated and not described directly or overtly. Another function of the old world order is that it often helps the audience understand the leading character's relationship to the theme of the play, which is something that often changes as the play proceeds to its conclusion. So we've talked about the old world order. Now let's talk about the new world order for a moment. The new world order essentially defines the world of the play once the major dramatic question has been resolved. As with the old world order, the new world order is seen through the eyes of the protagonist. The structure and content of the new world order tell the audience about the hero's journey through the play and allows them to come to their own conclusions about the play's meaning. The structure and content of the new world order tell the audience about the hero's journey through the play and allow them to come to their own conclusions about the play's meaning. The old world order can actually serve as a template for the new world order by creating parallel structures which allow the audience to develop this deeper understanding of the play's meaning. So, for example, if the protagonist was poor and unhappy in the old world, she might become rich and happy in the new world, or maybe poor and happy, depending on what the play is trying to say, if, for instance, the theme is something like money can't buy happiness. If information was hidden from sight in the old world order, it might be brought to light in the new world order. If someone was stubborn in the old world order, that person might become flexible in the new world. If a dark spell hangs over a kingdom in the old world, the darkness may be dispelled in the new. Supporting characters may or may not have gone through transformations over the course of the play as well, and all that would be set up in the old world order and then revealed in the new world order. The new world order can therefore, by design, provide a thoughtful contrast to the old world order. Elements, objects, actions, storylines that are introduced at the play's beginning are resolved or completed in the new world. Old and new world order work hand in hand, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about wrapping up storylines later in the podcast. Now, examples can actually help make clearer what old and new world order are and how they function. So I'm going to use the example of the well-known movie version of The Wizard of Oz with Judy Garland, which was made by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer in 1939. I actually love using this example, even though it's a movie, because from a narrative structure, it has all the key elements of narrative and illustrates them very clearly and cleanly. And the fact of the matter is that most people from most cultures are actually familiar with that movie and makes it really, really easy for them to follow the examples along. In that well-known movie version, Dorothy begins her journey as a girl who is irritable, restless, and discontented. She's experienced an altercation with the cantankerous Miss Gulch, and she's looking for sympathy. She doesn't get any. Everyone is too busy with their chores and responsibilities to talk to her. She decides she wants to be over the rainbow. Miss Gulch arrives to take Toto away. Dorothy's further upset, and she decides to run away from home. Her existence in Kansas is very, very unhappy indeed. And the tornado serves as a metaphoric expression of that disaffection. It takes her to the land of Oz and introduces the major dramatic question, will Dorothy get back to Kansas? Eventually, that question is answered, setting us up to see what's happened. As audience members, we want to know, has anything changed for Dorothy now that she's back in Kansas? And if so, what? How is it going to be different? Significantly, the primary thing that's changed in the New World Order is Dorothy's attitude. She's surrounded by the same characters at the end of the story as she was at the beginning. However, she experiences appreciation for them at the end of the story that she didn't at its beginning. She's living the message of the story. If I ever go looking for my heart's desire again, I won't go looking any further than my own backyard. Or, more simply put, there's no place like home. Dorothy's move from disaffection to appreciation for her family and community represents the arc of her character and is expressed by her changed attitude towards what are essentially the same circumstances. It's also significant that there were clues in the old world order that prepare the audience for its conclusion. It's obvious that Auntie Em and Uncle Henry and the various farmhands are good, loving people who are just distracted when Dorothy reaches to them for sympathy. They're not hateful, evil people. The audience doesn't have to wonder what happened to them while Dorothy was gone. The only thing that happened was that Dorothy is seeing them through new eyes, which of course is the point of the story. Frequently, the movie would tell us our attitude is really the only thing that needs to change. A more complex example is Hamlet, of course, by Shakespeare. At the top of the play, Hamlet, like Dorothy or like most good protagonists, is irritable, restless, and discontented. He's upset that so soon after his father's death, his mother has married his uncle, who is the father's brother. There are tensions between the countries of Norway and Denmark, and there's a concern that Norwegian forces might try to invade Denmark. The appearance of Hamlet's father in ghostly form introduces the major dramatic question. Will Hamlet avenge his father's death? The play explores this question, and ultimately the answer is yes. Once that question is answered, the audience sees that no good came from this vengeful act. Most of the members of the court have been killed, and Hamlet himself is soon to die. Norwegian forces are depending upon Denmark, which ultimately falls. The only consolation left to Hamlet is that his good friend Horatio can use his story as a warning to prevent others from making the same mistakes that he made. So Hamlet's life basically can serve as a bad example that others would not want to imitate. There is no peace for Hamlet in the New World Order. The story is a tragedy, and one of the rules of tragedy is that the hero must suffer for the actions he's taken, an action which is usually out of integrity with the moral principles of the universe, which, of course, the playwright gets to determine. The Music Man illustrates the contrast between old and New World Order quite well. In the show, a dark spell seems to have fallen over the land of Iowa. The opening song, Rock Island, establishes the disaffection of the traveling salesman whose world is changing around them. They specifically attack the character who will later turn out to be our protagonist, Mr. Harold Hill. They call him a bang-beat, bell-ringing, big-haul-great-go, neck-or-nothing, rip-roaring, every-time-a-bullseye salesman. That's Professor Harold Hill, Harold Hill. Harold Hill, who is on the train, decides to take his act to Iowa. And at the top of the play, he is everything the other salesmen say he is. Meanwhile, the citizens of River City are singing the song Iowa Stubborn, which is a hymn to their unwelcoming attitudes and small-mindedness. The librarian, who is a smart and exceptional woman, is unmarried, holding out for her white knight. Her brother has a speech impediment and is shy and awkward. The cute young town lovers are from different social strata and are unable to be together. Everything is completely out of whack. This is the old world order. By the end of the play in the new world order, everything has been set right. Harold Hill has had a change of heart and takes responsibility for his actions. The cold citizens of River City have warmed up and welcomed the stranger into their midst. Marion has found her knight, the little brother has gained confidence, and the mayor consents to let his daughter be with the boy from the wrong side of town. By the end of the play, all that was wrong is right. So now that we've established and defined Old and New World Order and looked at some examples from well-known plays, I'm going to say just a word about alternative forms and the basic plots. And in the handout, if you're following along, you can look for this on page 6. The Old World Order, New World Order model is usually found in the well-made play, which uses the basic concepts of narrative, the ones that I've been talking about in this series of podcasts. It's worth noting that the absurdist structure is a structure in which the old and new world order are identical. Absurdist plays, which are written by playwrights such as Samuel Beckett, reflect the worldview that life is random and chaotic and nothing makes sense. Nothing we do matters, and so there can be no change. By definition, then, the end of the story is essentially the same as the beginning of the story. Waiting for Godot is an example of this kind of play. At the beginning of Waiting for Godot, Vladimir and Estragon are waiting for Godot. At the end of the play, they're still waiting. Nothing has happened. This structure is by design to show that no change can take place. Godot never arrives. There are a few basic plots which recur in plays. And one of my favorite authors, Christopher Booker, illustrated some of these in his book, which is called The Seven Basic Plots. And each of the seven basic plots has a formula which it follows. And there's a formula for the New World Order as well, which typically involves a lesson that the hero has to learn. So if the basic plot is overcoming the monster, which might be found in a play about Dracula, the monster is, of course, overcome. That's how the story works. The hero is frequently an innocent who in some way must mature and then at the end of the story becomes fully a man or fully a woman. If the story is the quest, usually the hero or the heroine achieves the quest, though not always. And in the process, they learn something about him or herself. In a tragedy, the hero usually dies as the result of his poor choice-making, and the lesson is learned. Don't fool around with the moral order. It won't turn out well. If a play follows one of these basic plots or the others that Christopher Booker writes about, The old and the new world order often follow a formula or a set of rules which the writer can tweak or infuse with his or her own voice to bring the stories to life while following some time-honored storytelling traditions. So now that we've talked about the old and the new world order, let's go ahead and look at the first 10 minutes of the play. And the first 10 minutes is a topic that's very related to the old world order. So the old world order is typically established during the play's opening, and it's worthwhile to take some time to look at what a playwright might want to do to set the play up for success in those first few pages. Now, for the purposes of this podcast, I'm assuming that the writer is working on a full-length play, which would probably run from 90 to 100 pages in length. Therefore, the first 10 pages would be about the first 10% of the play. A 10-minute or a 10-page play would need to accomplish the setting up of these things in one page, and a one-act might need to get them out of the way in 5 pages. It would be difficult to overestimate the importance of the first 10 pages of a full-length play. Typically, a story is an exercise in setting things up and then paying them off, opening boxes, and then closing them. In a full-length play, many of the elements or the things that will pay off later in the play are set up in the first 10 minutes. Stories are told, which are later proven to be lies. Riddles are asked, which will later be answered. Hints about problems are dropped, which later burst into full-fledged, full-scale riots on stage. The old world order is established. The play's first 10 minutes help to set up facts and exposition, the protagonist's point of view, storylines and key images, and the tone and rules of the play. And I'm going to take all of these one by one and discuss each one in order. The first element I'm going to discuss are facts, or what's sometimes called exposition. To understand what's happening in the world of the play, the audience needs to understand the facts of the world they're experiencing. The play takes place in a specific location at a particular point in time, and particular people are on the stage with particular purposes and points of view. The audience will be willing to tolerate some ambiguity at the beginning of the play while they're figuring things out. But if there's too much that's unclear and it remains unclear for too long, the audience will begin to get restless. And this is more true of some members of the audience than of others. Different people in different audiences have different tolerances for the amount of ambiguity they can handle before they get restless. In the teaching examples that I referred to earlier, the audience learns a lot about the facts of the play right away. And this knowledge anchors the audience in the theatrical reality of the narrative they're experiencing. Some facts can be hidden away and revealed later. And again, as I said before, the more that's hidden, typically, the more uncomfortable the audience will become. So facts and exposition are delivered. The second key thing that's presented in the first 10 minutes is what I'm going to call the protagonist's point of view. By the end of the first 10 pages, the audience should have a pretty good idea of whose story they're going to be tracking. Generally, an audience should be able to hear the first 10 pages of the play and tell the playwright who the protagonist is. If they're unable to do that, or if the playwright gets different answers from different audience members about who is driving the story, the writer needs to have a very good justification for that, or else he or she is not really in control of the story or the point of view. Not only should the audience be able to identify who the protagonist is, but the audience should already have started the process of identifying with that person, or what's sometimes called cathecting that character. The character's circumstances, situation, or choices should be such that the audience is already beginning to feel empathy for that individual. In The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy Gale is an orphan living with her much older uncle and aunt. She has a sad story to tell about how she had a fight with a neighbor woman about her dog, to whom she's very faithful and loyal, and no one will listen to her. She feels misunderstood. Of course, she sings her song about wanting to get over the rainbow. Dorothy is our portal into the story, and right away, we have already started to identify with her situation. We've gotten onto the protagonal train. The protagonist need not always be completely likable. Nora in A Doll's House is quite complex. She's a smart and resourceful woman who is essentially under the thumb of a paternalistic husband. She has capabilities she obviously isn't using, and she has a secret. She made choices that she made for very good reasons, but they were very unfortunate choices nonetheless. She is the protagonist of the story, and we learn a lot about her right away. So as you can see, the first 10 pages help establish the protagonist, their point of view, and start the audience on the path of rooting for him or her. Next up is the storylines or the key images. The first 10 pages of the play begin to introduce key storylines and important images. A storyline is a plot element that recurs over the course of the play. It may involve a specific character, an object, or perhaps an outside force. As the protagonist pursues his or her goal, there are typically elements in the environment that will either support or block the character's ability to achieve the goal. So often these elements, these supporting or restraining forces, are storylines in and of themselves. In Raisin in the Sun, Ruth, one of the characters, one of the supporting characters, is pregnant and is going to have to make a decision about whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. In the opening scenes, many of the other characters comment on how tired she looks, and she brushes these comments off. Well, she looks tired because she's pregnant. Lorraine Hansberry carefully sets up this pregnancy in the opening scenes in a subtle way, and then develops the storyline over the course of the play when ultimately Ruth decides not to have an abortion. Characters often have their own storylines, and frequently in the first 10 pages, many of the key characters are introduced and their relationships to each other, some of their history, and their relationship to the protagonist may be explained. Key images may be introduced. One of the key images in Hamlet is the existence of the ghost of Hamlet's father. Right away, the audience is introduced to the concept or the idea that a ghost has been sighted. This key image, which of course is provocative, is presented in the first 10 pages. One of the key images in Raisin in the Sun is a plant that Mama keeps on the windowsill of her apartment. The plant is introduced early as Mama waters it, trying to keep it alive. And the final image of the play is Mama picking that plant up and taking it to the family's new home in Clyburn Park. If there are key images or themes that the playwright wants to leverage, they can be introduced in those crucial first 10 pages. Finally, let's look at tone and rules, which are often contracted for in the first 10 pages. So the basic tone of the play is usually established in these pages. Is it realistic? Is it a fantasy? Is it serious or is it comedic? The audience gets a sense of what to expect in the play and they calibrate those expectations. There is nothing wrong with varying tone. However, a playwright does so at his or her risk. It can be surprisingly difficult to establish a consistent tone in a play. And it can seem like a creative or offbeat idea to insert a wildly comic scene or an amusing piece of business in an otherwise serious play, or perhaps to unexpectedly vary or change the language or conventions. There's nothing wrong with playing around with tone and conventions. However, many playwrights who have not yet mastered the ability to create and maintain a single tone are tempted to experiment. And my suggestion for new playwrights is to start simple. Establish a tone and see if you can maintain it consistently for the length of your play. You need to know yourself what kind of play you are writing. Now, once you've mastered the ability to create and sustain a single tone, then you can feel free to experiment. And the key to establishing tone is to set it in the first 10 minutes. All of the five teaching examples have extremely consistent tones. Hamlet is a style piece with supernatural elements. Raisin is kitchen sink realism. Doll's House is a straight-up domestic drama. Music Man is a musical comedy. And Wizard is a fantasy. This internal consistency is part of what makes them classics. Now, related to tone are what I'm going to call rules. There are certain conventions that playwrights create. Does the play take place in a post-apocalyptic alternate reality? If so, what are the rules of that reality? How does it function? Does the character have superpowers? Again, how do they work and what are the rules that govern them? These norms are frequently established in the first 10 pages. The use of other theatrical conventions is often set up in the first 10 pages as well, such as the use of direct address or flashbacks. If these conventions are used late in the play without them having been set up or introduced earlier, it can actually throw an audience off balance and they find it confusing. At a certain point, the audience has gotten comfortable with what's being presented. They think they know what to expect, and that knowledge frees them to experience the story and the ideas that are being presented. While it's certainly possible to introduce a new convention late in the story, the playwright should do so advisedly. Now I'm going to talk about the first 10 minutes of a play that I wrote myself called Puppet Man. Now I used the first 10 pages of that play to accomplish several things. The play involved a lot of puppetry, so I wanted to start off with a puppet show and establish the conventions of puppetry and how it was going to be used in the play. I introduced the protagonist and his favorite puppet, and then on page 3 we go into a flashback. So the story is actually framed by a conversation between the hero and the pretty girl puppet that he has created. I introduce all the key characters, their defining characteristics, and their relationships to one another. I introduce the protagonist in the flashback as a character who felt that his life was over. The play takes place in prison, and the protagonist, named Luther, is a 23-year-old man who is serving a 22-year prison sentence. He feels his life is finished. He is shown to be stealing orange juice from the prison kitchen where he works, and he narrowly escapes being sexually assaulted by a predatory prison guard who uses his power to sexually abuse the men in the prison. He has a toxic relationship with another inmate in the prison who deals him the drugs that he uses to numb himself and escape his own painful reality. It's revealed that if he stops taking the drugs, he begins to hear voices and is concerned that he'll have what is essentially a psychotic break, which helps make him a more sympathetic character to the audience, even though he's a drug addict. In the first few pages, I establish facts, exposition, the protagonist and his point of view, storylines, key images, and the overall tone and rules of the world that I'm creating. So if you're following along in your handout, I'm going to let you know here that I'm up to page 10, pitfalls of the first 10 minutes. And there are some notable pitfalls to beware of in the opening of your play. The first is that because a lot of exposition needs to be delivered, the opening can become very talky and dull. There are a few ways to solve this problem. One strategy is to give the protagonist a clear dramatic objective that he or she is trying to achieve at the top of the play. So going back to The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy is trying to get help to solve her problem with Miss Gulch, and no one is interested in listening to her. In Doll's House, Nora is being visited by a friend who has, the friend actually has the objective, not Nora. She wants to get Nora to refer her for a job. The conversation influences Nora to share information about her husband's illness and her own role in helping him get well, lest her friend think that she has been living some kind of a life of leisure. Another solution, which prevents talky, exposition-heavy dialogue, is to reveal the exposition through conflict, and this is actually a great strategy. Raisin begins with the kind of good-natured squabbling that's present in any family situation, which is exaggerated by the fact that the family lives in very impoverished circumstances. Harold Hill, a known con man, shows up in River City and the Music Man, determined to sell its citizens a band that doesn't exist. Conflict! An exposition interestingly delivered. One of my writing mentors used to use the phrase stasis in motion, which describes the technique of providing a stasis for the protagonist, which is dynamic and therefore more engaging to the audience. Now, a second pitfall that playwrights fall into is the use of a narrator or a character speaking directly to the audience as a way of delivering exposition efficiently. Now, I've got to tell you, my bias is being revealed here. I'm not a fan of this approach. To me, part of the fun of writing a play is figuring out ways to deliver the exposition so the audience doesn't know that it's being told what's going on. For my money, using a narrator or director address is the lazy playwright's way out. The magic of the theater is that when the lights go down and the curtain goes up, the audience can be taken anywhere, any place, any time. It's an amazing moment of expectation. To waste that moment by having the audience discover that they're in a theater listening to an actor on a stage describing something to them seems a shame. Notwithstanding the fact that some of the great plays do use that technique, I find it inherently anti-theatrical. It does the work for the audience and is not nearly as engaging as other means of getting the information across. I would encourage the new playwright to experiment with ways to get the information across through dialogue and action and let the audience have the fun of figuring out what's going on. I once saw an adaptation of a well-known and much-loved novel, a theatrical adaptation. It was actually at a well-known theater. The playwright had decided to tell the story in flashback, and one of the characters, interestingly enough, not the protagonist, was now an adult and was recounting the story to the audience. It was not clear who the audience was or why we were being told the story. The teller did not appear to have any dramatic objective. She was just on a stage in a theater in downtown Indianapolis telling a story about something dramatic that had happened to her when she was a little girl. I didn't have to think about anything or figure anything out or even wonder about anything. It was all handed to me on a silver platter. After a few lines of dialogue, the actors would take over and begin to act out the story. And occasionally I fell under the spell of theater. And just about the time that happened, the narrator would step to the lip of the stage and explain to me what I had just seen and what I was going to see next, which totally took me out of the magical moment. Now again, there are no rules in theater. I love our town and its use of the stage manager as a narrator. Stephen Sondheim and James Lapine used their onstage narrator to wicked effect in Into the Woods. The technique can be used successfully, but in lesser hands than Thornton Wilder, the technique can seem at best uninvolving and at worst didactic. The high-level note on getting the first 10 pages right is you may need to write it several times before you write anything else. The first 10 pages are so critical to the success of the entire play that a writer may want to spend a little extra time crafting those pages to provide a foundation for everything that's going to come next. Writing a play is a process of discovery, however, so at a certain point, you get as close as you can to getting the first 10 pages right, and then you move on to the second 10 pages. It can, however, be worthwhile to spend a little extra time crafting those critical first pages before moving on. And there might be at least two or three drafts which can be valuable in grounding everything that's going to come next. And you can do a lot worse than taking those first 10 pages and having people read them out loud and getting feedback on it. Because hearing those first 10 pages yourself is going to tell you an awful lot about what you're up to and whether you're successfully accomplishing your mission in writing the play. Now that we've talked a little bit about starting the play, I'm going to shift gears and talk about finishing the play. And I'm just going to give a few notes because I'm going to be talking about wrapping up the play in a later podcast. But just as the old world order is established in the first 10 pages, the new world order is established in the final pages. And I'm going to say usually the conclusion of the play is a lot shorter than 10 pages. In the final pages of the play, the playwright has to put everything to bed. Once the major dramatic question has been answered, the play is essentially over. Now, in some cases, the first dramatic question is answered and it's immediately followed by another more compelling question. In these cases of successive questions, the story is over when the final and most compelling major dramatic question has been answered, yes or no. So once that question has been answered for the audience, the play and its storylines need to be wrapped up as fast as possible. In those last few pages, try to tie up all loose ends. Some writers, myself included, have more of a need for closure than others, so how much to wrap up will be a personal choice. I have to say that one of the things that's always bothered me about The Wizard of Oz, as much as I love it, is that the Toto Miss Gulch storyline is not conclusively resolved at the end of the movie. If Miss Gulch was killed by the tornado, Toto's safe. But we're never actually told that that's what really happened, or if that was actually part of Dorothy's dream. It's possible that Miss Gulch will show up the next day with a new order from the sheriff to have Toto put down. Then what will happen to Dorothy and Toto? That storyline is not really resolved. Now, most viewers of the movie don't seem to care about that. You, as the playwright, get to pick the storylines that are important to you and wrap them up. My belief is that the fewer unresolved storylines, the better. Readings can help here. If your initial reading gets a lot of feedback that the ending takes too long, you may be trying to resolve too much. If you get pushback that people want to know what happened to one of your supporting characters, you may not be resolving enough to satisfy your audiences. It's also worth noting that storylines need to be wrapped up in reverse order of importance. The biggest payoff comes at the end. Typically, the biggest payoff will involve your protagonist. Whatever key image or idea the protagonist was working with gets resolved as close to the end as possible. The final exchange of Raisin in the Sun is between Walter Lee and Mama, in which Walter says, "Y'all come on! These people charge us by the hour, you know!" And that reflects his understanding of his new level of responsibility as the man of the house. Mama then takes one last look at the apartment, grabs that plant I talked about before, and walks out the door. In Hamlet, after Horatio utters the famous line, "Good night, sweet prince," which is the last thing that Hamlet will ever hear, Fortinbras enters, surveys the scene, and orders Hamlet to be given a soldier's burial. And significantly, this restores him to a measure of dignity. He further orders his men to clean up the mess that they find, which of course is a bunch of dead bodies. And he notes that a sight such as this becomes the field, but here shows much amiss. And this statement and the implied action is a way of writing what was wrong, cleaning up the mess, and commenting on it at the same time. Finally, the playwright can effectively show how the New World Order is contrasted with the Old World Order. If the plant was dying in the opening scene, it's living in the closing scene. If the confirmed bachelor was spurning invitations in the opening scene, he's now accepting one in the closing scene. If the little boy was afraid of water in the opening scene, he's getting ready to dive into a shark tank in the closing scene. Balancing the opening and closing images of the play gives the play and the audience a sense of coherence and finality. In summary, the Old World Order is a critical component of the play's opening and the New World Order of its conclusion. So let's turn our attention to your assignments. And if you're following along in your handout, I'm now up to page 13. So I love suggesting that people get a playwright's journal so you can keep track of your ideas and your thoughts. If you don't have one, you should get one. And the first question is, I'm going to ask you to think about a play that you really like. And then analyze, compare and contrast the Old World Order and the New World Order of that play. How does the world at the top of the play parallel or mirror the world of the play at its conclusion? How are the elements similar and how are they different? How do they compare and contrast? That's question number one. Question number two is to actually analyze the first 10 pages or the key first scenes of that play. How much about the overall story does the playwright set up? What do we learn about the world of the play in those pages that you've identified in the play that you really like? What key themes, images, or storylines get introduced? How does the playwright communicate that information other than simply having the character state directly to the audience what's happening in the play? After you've answered those two questions, you'll turn your attention to the play that you're working on, the play you're writing. Now consider what you need to set up in the Old World Order that could be contrasted in the New World Order once the major dramatic question has been answered for you. What elements might be the same? What elements might be different, and how might they be different? for the play that you're working on, this actually brings us to question number four, what facts does the audience need to know at the beginning to understand the narrative? How will you make it clear who your protagonist is and get the audience to sympathize with that individual? What storylines or key images are important to you, and how might you introduce them in the opening scenes? Are there any special rules for your universe? And if so, how can you communicate them? And then finally, how might you describe the tone of your play? Can you establish it in the first 10 pages? So that's food for thought. Things for you to consider as you're working on your own play, reading other people's plays over the next month, and then getting ready for the next podcast. So to give you a sneak preview, in the next podcast, I'm going to be talking about the intrusion or the inciting incident. And I actually have a special topic I'm going to cover as well. I'm going to talk about supporting characters and how they function in a play. So we'll have those two things to talk about in the next podcast. I hope you've enjoyed this one. I know I've enjoyed sharing my thoughts with you. And I'll look forward to connecting with you again next time around. Take care. Happy writing.